This episode is sponsored by NuCom, and as many of you know, I only bring sponsors onto this show whose products I truly swear by. Now, we are an overworked and underslept population, especially those of us that wear uniform for a living. And trying to reclaim some of the lost rest and recovery is imperative. Now, the application of this product is as simple as putting on headphones and a sleep mask. As you listen to music on each of the programs, there is neuroacoustic software beneath that is tapping into the actual frequencies of your brain, whether to upregulate your nervous system or downregulate. Now, for most of us that come off shift, we are A, exhausted, and B, do not want to bring what we've had to see and do back home to our loved ones. So one powerful application is using the program PowerNap. A 20-minute session that will not only feel like you've had 2 hours of sleep, but also downregulate from a hypervigilant state back into the role of mother or father, husband or wife. Now, there are so many other applications and benefits from this software, so I urge you to go and listen to episode 806 with CEO Jim Poole. Then download NuCom, NuCalm, from your app store and sign up for the 7-day free trial. Not only will you have an understanding of the origin story and the 4 decades this science has spanned, but also see for yourself the incredible health impact of this life-changing software. And you can find even more information on NuCom.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show personal trainer and the man behind the Modern Warrior program, Gavin Meenan. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his childhood in Ireland, the tragic car accident that changed his world, porn addiction, his powerful mental health journey, the importance of exercise, post-traumatic growth, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of almost 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. And as a side note, my second book, Kinder, is now available on paperback and ebook on Amazon. So with that being said, I introduce to you Gavin Meenan. Enjoy. Well, Gavin, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
An honor, man. Big respect for yourself, big respect for your podcast. Absolutely love what you're doing, love the message. And yeah, the fact that you're up at almost 1,000 episodes is just an epic achievement. So well done, man. I'm privileged to be here.
Yeah, likewise. Privileged to have you. So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
I am in Sligo in Ireland. So I've been living in Sligo for about 15 years now. I come from Donegal, which is about 200 miles north of this. So yeah, Sligo is my home at the moment in Ireland.
Well, let's start in Donegal then. So tell me, you know, where you grew up in Donegal, and tell me a little about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Yeah, so was born and raised in quite a small village. And I had a pretty unique few years in my very early life. So when I was born, my parents were living in a mobile home that was right next door to my grandparents' house. And in my grandparents' house, I had a few aunties that lived there and an uncle that lived there. So I was born into this very large family, you know, quite a unique setting. For those first 3 years of my life until we moved away and moved into a new home. And the actual impact of that separation has had an incredibly, you know, difficult ripple effect on my life. It's, you know, that broken connection from those early years actually was the source for a lot of the difficulties that I experienced later on in life, but we can get into that later. My mum was a teacher, and later on she became a play school teacher, but she, you know, further on again, she was the stay-at-home mum. So she was the one always there looking after us, picking us up from school, making sure we're fed and clothed, and the real caregiver. And my dad was always working. He managed pubs, and he was managing a pub whenever I was a kid. He eventually moved on and bought his own pub when I was 13. And again, I spent most of my teenage years working behind the counter of a pub in a town where a lot of people were fond of the drink, and there was a lot of lessons that I took from that experience too. So yeah, he was a really hard worker, and something I've taken from him is that high work ethic. And my mom was also, like, as I said, you know, she was always there. She worked very hard, but for different reasons. So one brother then as well. My brother is just under 2 years younger than me, and yeah, we would have beat the shit out of each other when I was younger, but in recent years, we have grown closer together, and you know, that's been quite a important element of my relationship with him. Was repairing that, actually, because we're very different individuals, and I think for a long time he tried, maybe subconsciously, to fill my boots in terms of being the party animal and being, you know, the big drinker who can go out there and party all weekend without any issue. And I've been sober now for nearly 3 years, and he's been sober for a year. So the fact that I went sober actually inspired him to do the same. So some pretty cool things have happened over the last few years. So yeah, that's kind of where it's at. That's the long answer to that very short question.
Yeah, no, it's great. And this is funny how, I mean, that illustrates exactly how you can be a mentor and steer someone in the wrong direction, or you can be a mentor and steer them in the right direction.
100%. Yeah. I was definitely going the wrong direction myself for a lot of years. And then I started to turn things around. And you don't even have to try. Like, I never encouraged him to make these changes in his life. But from seeing me, you know, become better myself, seeing me become more confident without the use of alcohol, perhaps inspired him to do the same. But I think we all sort of need those moments where we get a cold, hard, harsh reality check that stops us in our tracks. And something happened with him before he stopped drinking. He had a pretty poor instant. I won't go into details on it, but he had a pretty bad night out, let's say, and that was the last time he drank. He just needed, he basically needed a slap in the face, which is exactly what he got to help him make those changes. And again, it's same was true for me as well. So I think that's unfortunate for a lot of men, but at the same time, it's very true that most men only make a change when they've nothing left to lose. So that was certainly the case for me in my life.
You spent all that time behind the bar. Did you ever notice, I mean, maybe it's more retroactively now, looking back with this mature lens, but did you ever notice any commonalities between the men that really propped up the bar, you know, the regulars that are there, you know, day in, day out?
Yeah. As I said, I learned a lot of lessons during my time behind the bar. And when you're in it, you don't realize, because when I was in it, I fucking hated being in it. And this is a small, fairly small pub in a very small village. And I would be there, you know, this would be my summer job, and I was maybe 15, 16. You open up the doors of the pub, and the people that come in the doors of the pub at 10:30 in the morning are not exactly the people who have their shit together in life. They're going to the pub to get their fix, their comfort, their escapism. And my dad was adamant that the customer was the most important person in the building, and he had cameras in the pub, so there was no getting away from this. So he would strongly urge me and encourage me to sit and speak to the customer, make them feel as if they are, you know, important, make them feel as if they matter. So I would sit in the corner, talk to these alcoholics, and they would tell me stories about how they had it all. Like, a lot of these men had it all, business, woman, some of them had families, and then lost it all through the through alcoholism. And again, you know, during those moments of hearing those stories, yes, a lot of sadness, a lot of empathy, but it's only when I come out the other side of that now, having gone through my own issues in life, that I can really understand the struggles that they went through. And it really helped me better understand people, I think. And, you know, there'd be one guy there, perhaps a couple of guys, but one guy there specifically who was a highly respected individual, and he would, you know, drive to the pub and he'd park up his brand new Jaguar. You know, this guy was a businessman, he was involved in construction, but every single day he was going to the pub and drinking. And again, being in a small village, small town, and these rules and regulations of drink driving weren't as strict as they were back then, you could get away with having a few drinks. So he was there every single day, and on the outside, successful, money, rich, and highly respected and feared by a lot of people. But deep inside, you know, he was really struggling because he needed alcohol for him to cope and function every single day. So I think a lot of what I took from my experience in the pub has really been a benefit of, been a big advantage of the work that I do today with the men that I speak to every single day who are going through some struggles in their own life. So yeah, and also it's a very macho and masculine environment to be in. So being quite a timid, shy, you know, 12, 13, 14 year old, you really have to grow up fast in that environment, because you'll get pushed around. You will get, you can very easily get abused emotionally, physically, by people in the pub as well. We had plenty of run-ins with people who we had to bar, you know, get into fights, and, you know, obviously that comes with the alcohol and the underlying difficulties or pain or anger that they're struggling with. So we had a few lucky escapes there as well, which again, you know, big lessons that you have to, you know, step up and somewhat, you know, be able to assert yourself even as a young man. So yeah, big lessons.
It's an interesting perspective, because I think we all know people just like that. On the outside, they're a respected firefighter or police officer or lawyer or whatever it is, and then you hear, you know, or see firsthand, you know, the behind the scenes, you know, and they are successful, but more often than not, there are these things that are underlying, you know. And I think a lot of that comes from early life. You touched on, you know, that trauma of being separated from that more, you know, cohesive, larger family. And they say it takes a village. And I think that's what we're missing at the moment. You know, we kind of push now to get our kids out, go get a one bedroom apartment of your own. And I don't think it makes any sense. You know, I think those multi-generational families, as long as they get on with each other, actually, I think they've got it right. So when you look back, talk to me about that, you know, as you've unpacked it now, the impact of your formative years on your struggles later.
Yeah, it was huge. And it's only actually in recent years that I began to discover the significance of that. Like, I'm 39 years of age and nearly 40. And up until the age of probably 36, 37, I never comprehended the incredible impact that had on me. And, you know, all throughout my life, you know, I've been asking questions, especially later on in my 20s and my early 30s, in terms of, like, why am I feeling this level of emptiness inside? Why am I addicted to pornography? Why, you know, can I not connect fully with a woman? Or why can I not connect fully with people? Why am I always holding back? Why am I pushing people away? And going back there to the separation of that family really gave me the answers in terms of like understanding that, you know, 3 years of age, up until 3 years of age, we moved away when I was just about three, nearly 4 years of age. And, you know, that to me is my family. Like, I don't look at that in terms of, oh, here's my mom, here's my dad, here's my little brother, and that's my family. And someday we're going to leave them because we're going to move into a new home. That, you know, that to a three-year-old, don't even comprehend that. Like, to me, this was my life, this was my family. And, you know, I didn't just have perhaps one mother figure in my biological mother. I had my grandmother, who was also perhaps a mother figure. I had an auntie who I was very, very close to, like deep, deep connection with an auntie of mine. You know, I'd call her my savior during those years. She'd be the one who I would run to for comfort, for soothing, if my parents were angry or upset with me about something that I've done. And, you know, my first childhood memory is one of me being left behind with my auntie because of something that I had done to upset my mum. And, you know, I still have memories of me crying as my mum and dad are leaving the house because the plan was to go with them. But that was my punishment, was to be left behind. So again, you start to internalize these reactions of other people and believe that there's something wrong with you, that you're a bad person, that you don't deserve love, that you don't deserve compassion, and you only deserve bad things to happen to you. Now, of course, that story is not true, but this is the story of a three-year-old that then followed me through all my life. And combine that then with the separation. So only in the last few months, I spoke to my auntie about this, who I just mentioned had a very close relationship with. And I almost couldn't believe it, but she backed up exactly what I believed. And she said, well, of course that had an impact on you. Of course that traumatized you. But she remembers things that I don't remember. She remembers when we did leave and I go to visit, that I'd be in absolute tears. And I wouldn't want to leave them, to go back to my new home. And, you know, she would be coming up with, you know, suggestions in terms of what they could possibly do to help me. Could he stay here a bit longer? Does he have to move? But ultimately, he had to go home. So the impact of that lost connection is what's had me, I believe anyway, what's had me searching for this connection all my life. And I found that connection in all the wrong places. I found that connection in porn. I found that connection in women and sex, but only in the physical sense, with, you know, no substance. So again, going back to what I mentioned, keeping people at bay. If they get too close, they could hurt me, they could leave me. And again, as a three-year-old, that's the story I created, that there was something wrong with me, I did something wrong, and these people left me. Of course, the story's not true, which means you've got to change the story in order to change those thoughts, change the behaviors, change your actions, and change your life, which I've been doing. But that's been the impact, and I believe that has been the core of the, I would say, the extreme addiction that I had with porn ever since my teenage years up until probably my early 30s when I completely healed and completely removed porn from my life. So yeah, that's been a huge impact. As I mentioned, I think it was also the loss of that comfort and soothing that my auntie offered me. So if I was stressed because something happened at home, if I was upset because my mum was upset over something I've done, I no longer had my auntie to run to soothe me, to comfort me, to say, hey, it's okay, you'll be okay, she'll get over it, it's not your fault. I no longer had that, so I had to replace that with something else that offered that same sort of soothing and comfort. And I think porn was the thing, and then, you know, women as well. So yeah, that's been a huge part of my healing process over the last couple of years.
What about sports? When you were in the school ages, what were you playing back then?
I'm laughing because coming from a small village, I don't know if you'd understand this. So I come from a small village in Donegal, and the only two sports really that were offered to us was football. So either soccer or Gaelic football, which is the Irish national sport, one of the Irish national sports. Gaelic football and hurling would be the two national sports here. But if you can't kick a ball, you're pretty fucked. And not just fucked in terms of you can't play that sport, but you're also fucked in terms of being respected by other kids. And unfortunately, I was the one that wasn't very good at kicking a ball. And combining that with, you know, back then being quite timid or shy or reserved, certainly very sensitive, other people's criticisms of me would really get to me, and I again would withdraw. So I did struggle a lot with bullying in those early years in school, and again, you know, looking back on that, it wasn't something that I dealt with properly. I think I went running to mommy and daddy come in, and they would sort of fix it for me. So again, it sort of warped my mind in terms of, well, if I've got a problem here, if I'm struggling, if I'm having a difficulty in my relationship, or if I'm difficulty with finances or difficulty in life, yeah, someone's going to come along and save me here, you know, because that's always what happened. And, you know, I can maybe complain about what's happening or play the victim, and, you know, eventually they'll step in and fix this for me. So I think I've got a son now who's nearly 7 years old, and it's a big thing I'm trying to teach him, that if somebody pushes you around, you got to push him back. If you get punched, you're going to punch him back. And I'm not going to be going there, running to school, talking to teachers to try and fix the situation for him, unless it gets out of control, obviously. I believe that sort of disabled my confidence to be able to stand up for myself and face these bullies. Eventually, I got there. Fortunately, I did find karate when I was 7 years of age, and I think I was pretty much forced into that because my parents could see that I needed to learn some self-defense. As I said, I was very sensitive. I was a very anxious child, probably based on what happened in those very early years. It was a huge part of it. But nobody's speaking about anxiety. Nobody's speaking about mental health back in 1991, when I was, you know, 6-7 years of age. So yeah, into karate. So I spent a few years in karate, worked my way up to a brown belt there, and that really instilled a lot of confidence. But again, it comes with that sort of safety element where you go to the karate club and you know you can, you know, spar people in the karate club and you can do your thing there. But in the back of your mind, you know there's an element of safety. You know it's not going to get out of control. It's not going to get out of hand. So to then take that onto the streets or onto the playground, you know, there's always a risk that things could go really fucking wrong and nobody's going to come along to break this up and to save you if somebody is on your chest, you know, beating the shit out of you. So I would still hold back when it came to violence or aggression, even though I had the ability to fight. And but it did instill confidence. But then when I was 13, I broke my wrist and I never made it to my black belt. But then when I was 15, I started kickboxing, really enjoyed that. And by 15, 16, my confidence really began to grow. I think kickboxing was something that really instilled a lot more confidence and esteem, because it was something I was really good at. And kickboxing, went on to boxing, and like going into the ring, and you know, I remember going into the ring once, and maybe one of my first sparring sessions in the ring, and I was in there with, you know, a boxer who was in his prime, possibly. He was certainly there a lot longer than I was, and hit him a jab in the eye, and he got an immediate black eye, and you know, hard luck to him. But to me, I thought, fuck, like I can actually fight. I can actually, you know, instill some damage here in a man if I have to. So now, in saying that, street fights have been rare. There's been a few tussles when drink was involved in my 20s and college and things like that, but it's generally something I avoid, because to me, to get into those type of situations, there's always the risk of somebody dying. And I did have a friend of mine actually who got caught up in something like that and did 7 years in prison for manslaughter when he was only 20, 21. Wrong place, wrong time, and wrong hit, or hit someone in the wrong place. So that's something I've avoided. Yeah, so that, again, that's a long answer to your question, but the main sport for me was martial arts, you know, somewhere around that kickboxing, boxing, you know, karate in the earlier years. I always enjoyed those individual sports more than team sports, because yeah, I was probably afraid to let the team down, because I didn't trust myself enough to be able to support them with my own abilities. And therefore I just took on the individual sports because, well, I don't have to worry about, you know, what anybody else is doing here. I just have to focus on myself and have to focus on, you know, this obstacle ahead of me, which is this man to overcome. So that to me worked quite well with my characteristics and personality.
There's a lot of parallels to my upbringing. It was actually Taekwondo was the very first thing, but then shortly after that, it was Shotokan karate for a while, and then back into Taekwondo. And then when I was doing Taekwondo, I even won like national tournaments, some with form, some for actual sparring. But that imposter syndrome is huge, and it is partly justified, because when you do sport, certainly Taekwondo, and then you get into the real world and you go take a kickboxing class, and they hammer that leg that you've been jumping up and down on, you know, and then punch you in the face, you're like, oh, okay, so I'm not as good as I thought. So it serves as a purpose too. But at what point do you say, okay, now, like they said, now I feel like I can hit? I did, you know, kickboxing and jiu-jitsu, and to this day at 50 years old, I still, there's that voice in me, like, doesn't matter who picks the fight with you, they're going to kick your ass. You know what I mean? And it's, you look at the training you've done, am I a tough man? No, but should I fare well against the average person? Yeah, but that imposter syndrome, you know, lives rent-free still. And it is, I'm sure, from that meekness when we were little.
Yeah, it's from being beaten up when we were small, being made to feel quite vulnerable and weak and soft. And yeah, I'm not too sure if that voice still lingers there. It's not something I entertain too much anymore, in terms of, you know, walking in the street and, you know, sizing up men, or that I feel if I was threatened, you know, could I stand up for myself? Could I fight back? It's not something that I ponder over too much. I would avoid those situations based on what I mentioned earlier. Like my friend getting caught up in that situation was a huge, huge lesson for me, because in those college days, I was reckless. Like alcohol had such a grip on me over those years in college, but, you know, based again on some of those underlying traumas that weren't addressed at the time, and trying to fit in and trying to be liked and trying to be the party animal and trying to make everyone else laugh and be happy. And if I make them laugh and they're happy, and, you know, they're going to like me, they're going to accept me, and I'll be the man and I'll be respected. And it's like, well, who the fuck are they respecting? Who are they liking? Who is this guy? So it was a whole false persona that I created, because I rejected my true self based on, you know, the bullies in my earlier years and the shame that I felt around my true self. But yeah, those college years, there was a lot of reckless behavior, and I did get into some tussles and some fights. But when I heard about what happened to my friend, you know, that was a huge, huge lesson for me. And I think ever since then, I've just avoided it. And I've his experience certainly changed my outlook in terms of violence and aggression and fighting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think why it's still prevalent in my mind is doing, you know, being a first responder, being a firefighter for so long, you're around a lot of violence, and you see, you know, you've got a kind of echo chamber of what people can do to each other. So the average person is not probably thinking about that. But I think, you know, especially law enforcement, I'm sure wasn't, they're probably even worse. There's an element of hypervigilance. And, you know, most people are super nice. But the other day, for example, there was a guy I watched almost cause a horrendous accident on the main road. And then he ended up pulling in the same supermarket that I went into. And then there was people, you know, loading their cars with the shopping and everything. And then he does like a burnout out. And so I throw my hands up and like, what? And he gets out of his car. And I'm like, oh, shit, here we go. And he was, you know, about my age, obviously in good shape, too. But what was interesting is I said to him, you know, look, I was a firefighter for a long time. I see what happens when people drive like this. You're going to end up hurting someone. And I'm still, you know, partly ready for, God forbid, you know, something, you know, physical to happen. He extended his hand and he shook my hand and he said, thank you. So he was probably just having a bad day. And hopefully maybe that conversation stopped him from, you know, causing an accident down the road. But of course, I'm very, very aware that that could have gone a very different way as well, especially in America where everyone's got guns.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just the way you communicated as well. You didn't make it personal. So you didn't say, oh, what the fuck were you at, you jackass? You're driving like a lunatic. You're going to kill somebody. It's like, I was a fireman. You know, based on that type of behavior, you could cause an accident. And, you know, you depersonalized him. But I think that's, again, part of maturity as well, is being able to communicate effectively instead of someone else sizing up to you and you feel the threat and perhaps you hit them before they hit you and you get into a scuffle and, you know, all hell breaks loose and somebody's up in court or somebody's in jail or somebody's in a hospital the day after. And yeah, like that level of communication, I think is quite powerful, the way you put that across. So yeah, nicely done, man. Like, nicely handled. Yeah.
Well, I mean, kudos to him as well. I mean, think about the humility that took for him. Yeah. So I have admiration for him too.
True.
Well, you talked about college. As far as career aspirations, when you were in school, what was it that you were dreaming of becoming?
Probably a footballer. The one thing that I struggle with so much. Yeah, I was a big Manchester United fan. Still am a big fan of theirs. So although I wasn't good at that sport, I loved it. And I would have spent a lot of time practicing at home. And like the difficulties that I felt in the playground actually spurred me on to improve in that sport. I did eventually get into a team in my teens, and I was decent. But yeah, those early dreams were probably being a footballer. But again, on reflection, there was nothing really that stood out to me as that's what I would love to do as a career in my earlier years. I kind of wandered through my life not knowing what to do. And I remember, you know, going through college and you've got the, what we call it here in Ireland, the leaving cert coming up, the final exam of your school years, and basically sets you up for the next step towards college or university. But you know, we're sort of, I believe, indoctrinated into this system where that's the way to go. You go to school, you finish school, you've got to go to university or college now. And there's no, well, at least for me, maybe no opportunity to step back and ask, okay, well, what is it that you want to do? Like, do you want to go to college? It's almost like there's an expectation to go to college, go to university. And I was pretty okay at school. Didn't try too hard, but I got by and I finished school. And again, putting down those colleges and those careers that I wanted to follow, I just thought, well, I like sports, so maybe I'll do something in sports. So I did like sports science, I added sports science there and maybe some business and sports courses. But deep down inside, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So but fitness and health was a big element of my life from probably my early teens as well. My uncle was big into bodybuilding, and like that was the first time I seen a set of weights, first time I seen a proper bicep. I still remember him flexing his bicep when I was like 10 or maybe 10 years of age. I was like taken back by the size of it. And again, looking up to someone as strong as him, I wanted to be like that because, as I mentioned earlier, I didn't feel that level of strength within. I felt anxious. I felt weak. I felt soft. So I started weightlifting when I was 15. Got a weights bench and some dumbbells and barbells for my 16th birthday, I think. And I was in my room, when I was 16. So I started doing a lot of training. And, that was a big interest, along with the kickboxing at the time. So sports was a huge element of my life, and that influenced my decision then to go into sports science, which I did a year in. Something happened then when I was 18. I was actually after my first week in college, and I had gone on to do sports science I got into a sports science course in college, finished my first week, but I arrived home that Thursday after a few days in college, and something I would often do is take my dad's car for a drive and, take it to the town to get something in the shop. And every single time I took the car, though, I took the piss as well, because I would take the car. I would get in touch with one or two of my mates, say, come on, we'll go for a drive. I've got the car here. And we go for a drive and we have a bit of crack. We talk and catch up. And that's what we did that Thursday. But on this fateful day, I took his car with three friends of mine and took a corner too fast and then crashed into the oncoming car. And the lady who was driving that car, she died on the scene. So that changed a lot from that point forward. I sort of checked out of college. I was still showing up. I was still going, but I checked out of it. Shortly after that, I wasn't interested. I was just up there. I was drinking. Again, it was an escapism for me because I wasn't at home where all those reminders were. Where all those people were that knew what I'd done, that knew what happened. And I could run away to college and drink and party and be with people that didn't really know me that well and certainly didn't know what happened, didn't have a lot of information on it. And that's what I did for a few months up until, I think it was the accident happened in September, Christmas time. I told my parents I don't want to go back anymore because I just don't want to be here. Really what I wanted to do was go home. I wanted to be at home because it's where probably I felt safe. Again, I was 18. I was scared. I was vulnerable. I felt very lonely. And they encouraged me to go back. So I went back to college then for a few more months. But as I said, I checked out. So went through that summer. A lot of drinking. And then again, trying to make a decision in terms of where to go next. And then eventually I moved to Sligo and started a business in sports course in Sligo, the town that I live in right now. And that became probably it was a 4-year course, but certainly 3 years of that was a lot of heavy drinking, a lot of partying, a lot of escapism. And, just a lot of suppression of pain through distractions and through the substances that I used. Porn, again, being another huge one. And that certainly influenced my success in college, certainly influenced my decisions in terms of what I wanted to do and who I wanted to become. Because I carry that level of self-hatred with me. I carry that level of guilt with me. I carry that level of pain and trauma with me for all of those years. And obviously that had a huge knock-on effect that, I only realized the impact of that again after I came out the other side of it. Because when I was in it, I couldn't see it for what it was. I was telling everyone I was okay, telling everyone that, it's fine. I'm over it. I've worked through it. And then every single night, I went out drinking. I was blackout drunk. And again, never stopping to ask the questions of, okay, why is this happening? And as well as that, I'm away from parents. I'm away from family. Nobody really knew what I was doing. I don't think they knew what I was doing in college. So So no questions were asked. I would show up at home at the weekends, say everything was fine. You know, had a good week. Say no more. So I think there's a huge something else that I find in a lot of men who are carrying pain or trauma is that they're, and it was true for me, is that they're afraid to go towards that pain or to feel the pain, because if they allow themselves to go there, they fear that they won't get back. They fear that they'll get stuck there. But, you know, it's quite the opposite. You're stuck there because you're not going back. At least this was true for me. You're stuck there because you're not going back. You're not revisiting the pain. You're not allowing yourself to process it. And you're stuck because you're not going backwards in order to move forward, move on with your life. So yeah, that was obviously a huge episode of my life, yeah.
Were there any legal ramifications of the accident?
Yeah, I was in court maybe 18 months after it happened, and I was charged with dangerous driving causing death, and there was a risk of imprisonment. But massive credit to my mum and my dad. They did a lot of work to keep me out of jail. Got me the best possible solicitor. And this guy had quite a high success rate in terms of helping, you know, young men who get involved in similar situations as I was in. They got hundreds of references from people that, you know, knew me, teachers, coaches, people that, you know, had, you know, people that knew me that were in, you know, highly prestigious positions. So all these were brought to the judge on the day. And the most significant part of that was three of the deceased woman's sisters showed up on the day of the court. I didn't expect this. I don't think anybody knew that they were going to show up. And they sat at the back of the court, and one of the sisters decided to go to the stand. Maybe this was expected, that, you know, some of the family members would show up. I wasn't too sure how this was going to play out. And she stood at the, I don't know what it's called, but she stood up next to the judge and told the judge that she and her family did not want me to be imprisoned or to go to jail. And that was massive. You know, that level of forgiveness, level of empathy, level of care, level of consideration is something, again, that's had an incredibly huge impact on my life, and I think really influences the type of work I do today. Because, again, a lot of men do a great job of beating themselves up, criticizing their past behaviors and actions and things they've done wrong, and, you know, really struggle to forgive themselves. But no matter what you've done, to a certain extent, no matter what you've done, okay, like if you've killed somebody or you've done something extreme, you know, that might be outside of the equation. But, you know, within that, if there's something you've done that you feel is so wrong, so bad, that you're a bad person because you've done it, you know, you just struggle to forgive yourself. It's to know that there's actually somebody out there that, you know, has that level of forgiveness and has, you know, that level of love and consideration for you. And, you know, that in itself could be enough just to give you the initiative to move forward in your life. And again, at the time, I didn't really appreciate it as much as I do now, having come through the other side of it. Because the big thing during those years was the level of hatred and the level of guilt, the level of shame that I felt over what I had done. And the deceased woman's family have been nothing but supportive to me ever since that incident happened. I'm not in touch with them anymore, don't see them anymore, but during those years they were incredibly supportive. The weekend of the accident, I was allowed to go to her brother's house where she was, where the wake was, and, you know, go and say my goodbyes and pay my respects. And, you know, they open up that door for me, and they allowed me to go there when nobody else was going there, because, you know, if people from the public were there, you know, it could be quite difficult for me and for them. Could be a lot of questions asked. And, you know, ever since it happened, they've been very supportive and very forgiving. And even, you know, I would have bumped into her nephews in that small, again, that small village, that small town I come from. You can't really hide away from these people. And, you know, her nephews would come up to me, and, you know, there was never any blame. There was never any animosity, never any hatred, at least to my face anyway. And I would be there in a pub, you know, whatever, drinking my sixth, seventh pint and feeling sorry for myself, or, you know, pretending to have a good time. And one of her nephews would come up to me, and I would tell him, man, I'm just, fuck, like, I can't believe what I've done. I'm fucking such a dick, and I'm so sorry for, like, you know, what's happened here. And he's like, look, that could have been any one of us. Me, my brothers could have taken my dad's car and caused an accident. It was an accident. You didn't mean for this to happen. But to me at the time, that just went over my head. What I wanted to hear was what I believed about myself was, yeah, you're a dick. We hate you. Can't believe you've done this. You're such a bad person. And that would have just confirmed, that would have satisfied the belief that I held within. So a huge part of this process has been forgiving myself for what happened. That's been the final piece, really, that I've only got to, I'd say. This year, yeah, I would say this year, I've only got to that point. 21 years later.
I mean, that is such a powerful story. I mean, all the pieces, obviously, and, you know, the, as you said, the shame and the guilt from a mistake. And this is something that I talk about a lot in America. The driving standards here are so low, and then you add in the mental health crisis, you know, these troubled, you know, youth that are overcoming things through alcohol or, you know, whatever it is, and that may result in an accident on the road as well. But to hear that level of forgiveness as well, you know, and I've heard that before, and I've shared videos, you know, of people that forgave the murderer of their son, you know, I mean just, and we're talking, like, you know, deliberate shooting. I mean, none of us will know if we're capable of it until we're tested, and I hope none of us do. But that is, you know, so incredibly powerful, because, as you said, the expected result is hate, and that's only going to create more, you know, hate in the world. So, you know, the maturity and the compassion of their family, you know, to not only obviously help them heal themselves, because that is a very healing thing to be able to forgive, but also to give that gift to the person who took away their sister. I mean, incredible, absolutely incredible. So I'm so glad you shared that. Thank you. So you mentioned about the negative coping mechanisms. Obviously, you know, I've talked about alcoholism, some of these other things many, many times on here, but the porn addiction is kind of one of the ones that's under the rug a little bit. When you look physiologically at you know, a climax, especially in men, there is a down regulation of the nervous system. So whether it's porn or infidelity, there's a physiological reason there. Talk to me about the solace that you found in porn. And then I want to kind of add something as well. Did you find yourself then requiring more and more extreme porn? Because I look at it, you know, a lot of times you look at some things that are kind of flashing, you know, because I, of course, I've been, you know, on porn sites too. And you have your vanilla porn, and then you have the other end of the spectrum, you know, and it seems like, I can't help but feel like a lot of people aren't in the vanilla anymore. And I would assume that that was an overstimulation of whatever, you know, receptors it is in the brain, that as you progress and you keep watching it, there's a downward spiral in the kind of porn that you're watching too, or the kind of porn that you need to get you off.
Yeah. Yeah, that the dopamine effect just just doesn't have the same impact anymore, based on what you're potentially frequently exposing yourself to. So, perhaps in a way it just becomes a lot more expected and therefore not as exciting because you know what's coming and it doesn't really have that thrilling aspect to it. But yeah, my journey with porn has been an interesting one. Again, coming from a Catholic family where, you know, possibly sex is something that's, sex and nudity is probably something that's, you know, has a lot of stigma and shame attached to it. Perhaps not consciously, but subconsciously, it's certainly there. And I think that had an impact. And not to sort of point fingers or blame anybody here, but I remember when I was maybe 15 or 16, I had this diary, always kept diaries, and I'm still writing a journal today. That's something else that has been quite a useful tool in my life. But I had these paper cutouts of maybe page 3 models or whatever in my diary and had it hidden under my bed. And my mum found it one day and she made me throw it into the fire. She was so disgusted about what she found. Now, I think it was shortly after my grandmother died. And, you know, she's probably going through her own difficulty there. And again, I don't blame her for what she did. But the point I'm trying to make is how that potentially warped my feelings and my belief around nudity and around sex. It's, oh, this is bad. I shouldn't be looking at naked women. And it's almost like the poison chalice. And the more you feel like you shouldn't have something, the more you sort of want it as well. And then it becomes very secretive. And I always sort of had that double life, perhaps. And I go back, you know, before the porn days or even during the porn days in my house, I'd have my own bedroom. And in that bedroom, I would lock the door and I could have the music blaring, you know, I'd be playing. I had loads of albums. I loved music, still do to this day, but rock was my preferred genre. So it would be, you know, Queen or Guns N' Roses or Metallica or Green Day or, you know, one of those bands. But in that bedroom, man, I would be going fucking mental with the music. Like I'd be, you know, it's a form of expression. And I was like free to do whatever I want. Nobody's looking at me. Nobody's going to shame me. Nobody's going to laugh at me. But then, you know, unlock the door, walk into the kitchen or walk into, you know, somewhere else in the house where my parents were, very different person, you know. So I wouldn't, you know, express myself in the same way. Like I would keep that part of my identity or part of my characteristics hidden from view. And I think porn sort of just latched onto that. So that sort of double life that I lived, very secretive life where, okay, I can go over here and I can, you know, listen to music and express myself and be free. Then it was, I can go over here and I can express myself through porn. I can watch whatever I want and be free to, you know, indulge myself in these pleasures. And nobody has to know. It's all very secret. It's all very private. So that then became, you know, the thing, you know, music didn't do it anymore. Like I wasn't getting the same thrill from music. So I had to find something else. And, you know, I remember I'd always be doing things to piss my parents off subconsciously, but I remember they were away for a few days, just a trip away, a break away for a few days. I think it was maybe 16 or 17 at the time, old enough to be left at home for a few days, or at least they thought. And myself and my friend decided not to go to school for, you know, those few days when they're away. So my friend would come from his house and sneak into my house and we'd spend all day in my house, you know, eating or watching movies. But then we also found something else. And this was sort of the beginning of the internet. Like we're old enough to remember dial-up internet and life before internet. So like when the internet came, I was like, whoa, holy fuck, like we can see naked women just with a click of a button. We can, it's like open up a whole new world, which, you know, maybe people of this generation can't understand, but for me and you, like I think we know what we're talking about here. So we got into these like chat rooms where there were they were like sexual chat rooms, and there was loads of different chat rooms. But what we did was I'll laugh at it now, but what we did is we pretended to be a woman, and we downloaded all these images of this naked woman. She had like maybe 20 images of her topless or naked or whatever else. So we go into these chat rooms and chat to other women, or at least other women, could be men on the other side.
And we would, each other.
Yeah, yeah. And then we would to start chatting them, but then we start exchanging photos, and then we send them a photo of our woman, and then they'd send a photo of themselves, or you know, most likely probably you know, a collection that they had. So then it became this like exchange of photos, and built up a whole gallery of like naked women. I was like, fuck, this is cool, this is amazing, like we can just like get different photos of all these random women from you know all over the world. And yeah, so then of course we got caught and we were suspended from school and whatever else happened after that. But that had a knock-on effect with me in terms of, holy fuck, like this is actually very exciting and thrilling. Like I can actually get photos of naked women by pretending to be somebody else. So that was the start of something quite extreme. So again, for a long time, pretended to be this woman. Maybe not for a long time, maybe for a few months. And then I started to go, okay, well, what if I maybe, you know, pretend to be myself and I'll start chatting to these women, and then, you know, I'll lure them in some way into sending me photos of them. And that sort of began to happen. And there was like exchange of photos from me to them and back and forth. And then it went on to webcams. So there was no such thing as webcams back then. And you know, webcams then became a thing. You could actually attach a webcam to your computer or maybe your laptop. I think maybe after that, yeah, I got a laptop, and you could start chatting to these women from these chat rooms or from somewhere else. Yahoo Messenger, I think, was maybe the one that I used. I started chatting to these women, and my only intention was, I want to get this woman naked, and like I want to, get into some sexual or explicit conversation exchanges of photos, or not exchanges of photos, exchanges of webcam viewing. Like she's getting naked, I'm getting naked, and again, that was something else that was very thrilling and exciting. So like you mentioned, it was photos, webcams, and then on the side, you know, it was you could go to Google and you get these naked pictures, but then it became videos, and then it was very, as you mentioned, softcore and amateur at the beginning, and then you know started to grow into something more extreme. But the webcam thing was something that really appealed to me, and you know, perhaps I sort of justified that as this is not really porn. It's not really porn, is it? Porn's only if you're masturbating to photos, or if you're masturbating to videos of women. This is not really porn. This is a bit more real. So I sort of justified in that way. Now, this is during my teenage years, and it's during those years as well, I did struggle massively with confidence around women. So again, probably based on my earlier experiences that I talked about before, the trauma and not allowing someone to get too close. And to get too close, I get quite anxious. And when that did happen in sort of intimate situations with women as a teenager, I would get anxious. And of course, if you're anxious, nothing's going to fucking happen. So every type of situation that I got into with a woman that would potentially lead to an intimate situation, I then started to avoid, because I was like, yeah, but I know I'm going to struggle. I'm not going to be able to perform, but I can go over here and I can go on this webcam, and I can do whatever I want there. And I felt somewhat more at ease, more comfortable, because she's not in the room. I can switch this webcam off anytime I want. And there was an element of safety there because it wasn't physical. So then again, based on what I wasn't getting in reality, this fantasy became a lot more, it tightened its grip on me a lot more. So that became the thing. And this kind of journey went on, where sort of just that double life of not getting what I desired or wanted in reality, and instead finding it in fantasy through these women that I was never going to meet. Now during those years, I'm trying to think now, but during those years, it sort of simmered down for a period of time. The car accident happened then, and it probably ramped back up again. Drink as well was a huge factor, and any sort of escapism that I could find that wouldn't allow me to be alone with my thoughts at all. I remember going to bed and I wouldn't be able to sleep unless I was listening to music. So, and again, never questioned it. So, and to fast forward, because I could be here all night talking about porn, but to fast forward to a time then later on in my life when I was working, and 2.5 years into this business with this company I was with, I was made redundant only after a couple of months after my daughter was born. And this again, I was 26, 27. There was no trauma processed. There was no pain healed. And it was the first time in my life for probably the bulk of a year where I actually had time to do nothing. Well, I decided to do nothing. Could have done a lot of things, but decided to do nothing. So I'd be at home. I was a stay-at-home dad, more or less, for my daughter. But she'd go to bed and she would sleep for, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours sometimes in the afternoon. And I'm like, I can't leave the house because I have to look after her. And, you know, I was probably, you know, not probably, I was feeling very sorry for myself. You know, a little pity party for myself every single day. Oh, poor me, stay at home dad, such a bum, you know, but not doing anything about it. But then I found the soother, which was porn. But then I stumbled across these webcam chat rooms. And this was, again, something completely new, where you'd be in these chat rooms and you turn your video on and everybody can fucking view you, see you, give you attention, praise, validation, all these things that I probably felt that was starved of at the time, you know, just kind of filling me up with their words and their compliments. And like, you're in there performing, basically. So that became, fuck man, that became like ecstasy. Any opportunity I had, I was in that webcam chat room. But again, I started to work myself, because the guilt of what happened in the car accident actually gave me the incentive to reach out for help through a counselor. Got talking to someone, started to improve myself, started to read books, started to like really get to grips with the pain that I was carrying. And over that period of time, I realized that, look, I've got to let this fucking thing go. Got to let this webcam thing has to stop. Take responsibility for my life. And then I started a personal training business. So things were going really well. And like 2 years, maybe 2 years after I left that webcam, left the webcam chat rooms and stopped all that, I got a call from a friend one day when I was in the gym, and there was a sense of urgency in his voice, sense of panic in his voice. I was like, what the fuck? What's going on here? This is a friend that never calls me, by the way, never reaches out to me. And he calls me out of the blue and he tells me, Gavin, there's a video circulating of you in a webcam chat room. It's been circulating around Sligo, the place I live. One of the lads told me about it, and then I just got into a fucking haze of panic, and then a blur and a hurry and a rush. I got home onto the laptop, tried to remove that video off the porn site that I was on as soon as possible. Took 2 days for it to be removed, but a lot can happen in 2 days. A lot of people seen it. A lot of people see me completely fucking exposed in a webcam chat room. And yeah, now everybody knows my secret. Now, this is, again, understanding a time when I was building a solid reputation as being possibly the most sought after personal trainer in my town. Had a pretty successful online business too. Things were really starting to turn around for me. And then this comes out. And again, for 2 days, I was a pretty bad place. It lingered for longer, but I was in a really bad place for 2 days. I had a mentor at the time that really helped me out. And I decided that I could either use this experience or I could be used by this experience. So I decided to use experience and help other men who are possibly struggling with the same thing that I did, because I knew that 100%, I'm not the only person who is addicted to porn, not the only person who has a problem with porn. I'm definitely not the only person who's also in these webcam chat rooms, because I was in those webcam chat rooms and they were fucking full of people. So, and even if it's not porn, it's something else, it's some sort of other addiction. So I decided then to change my messaging, started to tell my story, started to put more in-depth content out there for men. It sort of shifted from fitness to, you know, mental health. And ever since, you know, that's kind of been where it's at. I wrote and published a book that was then released maybe a year after that happened. So again, as I mentioned in the beginning, you know, something really shitty had to happen. I had to get to that bottom of the pit before I made a significant change in my life. And, you know, that change that I made back in 2000, and that was probably 2016 or 2017, is still, that still has a ripple effect today on what I do. So there's value in these difficult situations that you may be experiencing in life. Now, the struggles are actually there to perhaps veer you towards a new path of success and prosperity, or something better in your life. And at least that's been the case for me.
There's so many people that have been on this show that have really struggled. And obviously then they've had to go through their own crucible and find the tools that work for them. And every single one of us obviously has an individual toolbox, which is why it's so dangerous to say, oh, this works for everyone. EMDR, you know, talk therapy, drugs. But then what I see is in another layer of healing, when they realize they can use their story and their journey to start helping other people, and it puts purpose in their life. Did you have that same experience?
Yeah. That's something I, you know, probably reflected back on quite recently, is looking back at some of the content that I started posting after that incident and after I started to make that change in my life and change my message. And a lot of the stuff I was putting out there was actually things that I wanted to believe about myself. It was actually things that I needed to hear myself. But I was putting it out there to other people. And I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. I think it does happen a lot with these content creators or people who are in that sort of self-development healing space, that they're putting a lot of messages out there that are reflective of their own struggles in life. And as I said, I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I think you always need to ask the question, okay, whose needs am I actually serving here? Am I putting this out here to serve my own needs, or am I putting this out here to maybe serve someone else's needs? You know, someone that needs to hear this today, someone that needs this message, someone that needs this inspiration, someone that needs to hear this story. So that's something I've started to question. Again, probably only this year started to question that. Anytime I put a post out there now, it's, okay, am I putting this out because I want to receive something back? Like I want to receive some validation or attention or likes or follows? Or am I putting this out because I firmly believe that this piece of content or the story is actually going to help someone else out? So I think that's an important question. But that's my opinion. As I said, I don't know if there's a right or wrong with that. Be interested to hear your opinion on it, actually.
What I have seen is that I think most people go into it with good intentions. The problem is that social media can drag you down a very narcissistic path. And I've watched many people go from, this is my project, this is my passion, to every single video is them with or without their shirt off, you know what I mean? And you're like, okay, this is about you now. This is about the likes. It doesn't mean that you can't pull yourself back, but I see that a lot. And I ask myself that even with some posts that, you know, the point I want to make is valid, but I'm like, but is this really going to make a difference in a positive way? It might be right, but is it going to make, you know? And so, and then I'll pull myself back and go, okay, let's stay away from that topic. Let's, you know, focus on, just like you said, I want mine to actually put, you know, I want someone to open it up and go, I feel a little better today. You know, that's the community and kindness that I believe is in this country, for example. So yeah, but if it becomes, you know, this is me, you know, every single time and kind of imparting wisdom like I'm the next freaking, you know, guru or Jesus Christ, then, you know, at what point do you kind of look in the mirror and go that you started well, but you've kind of fallen off a little bit. Let's try and find that true north again. Because, you know, if you've got something worth saying and you've got a story that people can learn from and you know, find strength in, absolutely tell it. But yeah, be aware that the entire social media construct is designed for narcissism to thrive.
Yeah, that's a great point, by the way. Yeah, that, I definitely got caught in that loop for a period of time. And yeah, I was putting content out there that I knew would get a lot of likes and followers, comments. But that was the only reason I was putting it out there. Like, again, I think during the time I didn't have the awareness to realize what I was doing. But then, as you mentioned, you know, that algorithm can take a grip, and you put up, and that happens to me quite often, where I put a post out there and it might only get whatever, 1,000 views. And again, I have to reflect back on myself and say, well, is what I said there authentic and genuine, and was it good, done with good intentions? And if it was, then why am I, you know, worried about the views? Now, I might be a bit pissed off that it didn't reach more people, that it could potentially impact more people if it got a further reach. That might be the only thing. And then I put a post out there that's maybe, you know, 35,000 views or something like that. You know, I think there's a recent one out there, 35,000 views. But again, it's the same question. It's like, do I really care about the views? And I do believe at this stage that the views don't matter to me. It's the message behind the content that's really important. It's asking that question of, okay, there's someone out there who is possibly in a similar situation as I was when I was 26 years of age, struggling, you know, playing the victim, feels hopeless, and feels like the whole world's against them. What did I need to hear back then that I could now deliver to them? And you know, that's most of my content is based off that very question. It's like, okay, I've been there, I've gone through it, but if I could give my previous self a little piece of wisdom or something that would initiate some element of hope or inspiration for them to make, for me to make a move, or for them to make a move, what could that be? So we don't always get it right, but yeah, that algorithm is a beast. And if you don't have the self-awareness to understand that you're being pulled down that dark hole of narcissism, then you can get lost there for sure, 100%. And you lose yourself, you lose the message, and you're doing things that ultimately deep down inside you don't believe in, but you believe that it's going to bring the validation, the praise, the attention, and the success. But it's, you know, success without substance.
Yeah, it's funny. I see people that have clearly gone to one of those influencer workshops, you know, the speaker workshops, and all of a sudden now it's the same thing. They're given the same advice, and you know, I think that, you know, people are so used to that. It is an algorithm. It's a template rather than someone who's raw and authentic. And we've all seen those videos where it's, you know, a guy broke down in tears, you know, in his car, talking about something, or you know, whatever it is, and you're like, okay, this is genuine. I'm gonna listen to this. But you know, if anything starts with "Hey guys," you know, it's gonna be shit. So
yeah,
you know what I mean.
You got to get the right hook line now, isn't it? It's all about the hook line.
Exactly. All right. Well, I want to get to what you're doing now. So, talk to me about the Modern Warrior Program.
Well, the Modern Warrior Program is a lot of what I've talked about already in terms of bringing men from a place of lack, a place where they struggle with their self-esteem, a place where they're maybe a little lost, or a place where they feel like a lot of the men that I reach out to, they have achieved a lot in their life. They've succeeded. They have the money. They've got the car. They've got the family. They're high up in their career. But they still feel like they're lacking. They still feel that level of emptiness inside. And it's to then help them fill that up, you know, fill up whatever they feel is has been somewhat maybe neglected due to the pursuit of success in the outside. Because again, we get caught into that system of believing that when I am successful, when I have the money, when I have the car, when I've got the family, you know, then I'll be the man. You know, then I'll be happy. Then I'll have it sorted. Then I've got all my shit together. It's like, nah, it's not it. And I'm sure you've experienced that. I've certainly experienced it. This pursuit of happiness is actually a pursuit of healing the parts within that, in a way, initiated that journey towards achievement, towards success, but then realizing that that's not the thing that's going to bring you that level of fulfillment or contentment or peace within. So a lot of the men that reach out to me are sort of at that place. Some men reach out and they're struggling with addiction, maybe porn or alcohol, or you know, maybe some other substance. A lot of men these days do struggle with cocaine as well. Now, everyone that reaches out, mainly, are still quite functional. They're still getting up. They still have a job. They're still moving forward. But it's just they feel that there's something lacking and they don't understand what it is. So it's my role then to help them uncover that. And it usually, again, comes out, or they usually reach out at a time when they've potentially lost something significant, lost a girlfriend, lost a marriage, lost a job, lost some sort of opportunity, and they begin to realize that, this has been happening quite frequently, this has happened before, and I thought if I pursue this again, that I would have had it sorted, or I could, you know, find that thing, and then I'd feel good about it again. But then realizing that, okay, hang on a second, maybe it's me. Maybe it's something in me that's causing this to happen. So there's a perhaps a point of realization in every man's life where, as I mentioned, they feel like they have it all, but they still they're still lacking something there that they just don't know where to find it. So my role, to bring them on that journey to finding their true self that they've potentially repressed or suppressed in their earlier years. And they've been living this this life that was carved out for them by teachers or parents. And it's not one that they felt or feel that's true for them. You know, if it was up to them, they'd be living a very different life in a very different situation and exerting very different actions and behaviors. And it's to bring that part of them back into their life. If that's part of it, and then getting their body and their physical shape as well is quite important. That their physical health and their well-being is very important too. So I sort of merge both of those things in. It's basically like the title of the first book I wrote, which is Stronger Mind, Stronger Body, Stronger Life. So you combine the mind, the body, your life will look after itself. So if that answers your question.
It does. And just before we kind of find out where people can find the course and the books, what are some of the tools that you bring to the table that these men haven't kind of, you know, had on their radar before?
Quite simply, it's about creating a safe space for men to just express whatever feelings or thoughts that they've been carrying with them that they've not felt safe enough to be able to share with someone else in their life, especially, you know, their wife or their spouse is someone that they struggle to open up to, because there's that expectation on men to be strong and assertive and masculine, and, you know, not to be too emotional and not to, you know, break down in front of a woman. So they hide that part of themselves in the relationship, which of course creates problems in the relationship, because you're not showing up as your best version. You're carrying a lot of baggage and a lot of things that are weighing you down. So, like, that's the first part, is just to understand that this is a safe space. I'm not here to judge, because, hey, I've been where you are, you know, to some degree. I spent a lot of time hating myself and criticizing myself and beating myself up, and I've been lost and I've been depressed and I've been anxious. So, like, you know, I understand what you're going through. So I'm not here to judge you. I'm meeting you at your level. So I think that's one of the most important aspects. But along with that, then, it's about creating space in their own life to be alone. And in that place of peace, without distraction, they can allow for whatever feelings or thoughts, again, that are coming up for them in their life that they're usually distracting themselves to avoid, which, again, I've done. I'm sure you've perhaps done, certainly a lot of men do. And these distractions could be deemed as healthy things, you know, working, going to the gym, you know, doing sports, you know, even whatever, watching TV. But there's no element of, hang on a second, did I stop here for a few minutes and check in with myself today? Did I stop here and just pay attention to what's going on within me instead of paying attention to everything that's happening around me? So that's a very important tool that I've taken on board and something I share with them. But not just to sit there with these thoughts and feelings and become overwhelmed with them, but to give them a tool then to help them process the painful feelings or emotions. And that is usually a journal. I'm a massive advocate for a journal. And they're writing things down and they're processing thoughts and they're putting some structure on their feelings. And again, bring it back to me. It gives us something else to have a conversation about, because things that might be coming up, you don't know why they're there. You don't know, I've got this feeling, but I'm not too sure where it's coming from. And it's usually something linked to, again, as I mentioned before, a very early experience that you possibly repressed or suppressed because it's too painful to revisit that. So we have that conversation. And again, it opens up more doors for them to become more aware of why they're thinking and acting and behaving in a certain way based on a story they've created in their early life. And then to help them change the story to something more empowering, something more positive that brings more empowering and positive results and outcomes in their life. So conversation is really important. I do speak to them twice a week, and combining that with the physical element too, which they go into the gym, you know, they've got more energy then to transfer into their healing journey as well, because they're looking after themselves. They've got the nutrition, you know, on track. They're sleeping better. They feel better, they look better. And along with that too, it's really just about being able to be present with yourself. You know, we can't be present with ourselves, I don't believe, anyway, unless you're a guru of some sort. You can't be present with ourselves like every single minute of the day, but allowing yourself to be present with yourself in certain opportunities of the day and catching those triggers when they do arrive. So your kids may say something, or your wife may say something, or your boss may say something, or somebody behaves in a certain way and it provokes you. But that's information for you to take on board, because it's provoking an underlying pain that you've not yet addressed. All you're hearing is noise coming out of somebody's mouth, but you're applying some sort of meaning to that based on something that you believe about yourself. So that pain or that insecurity or whatever that might be, that struggle just comes to the surface. It's like, okay, catch that. That's a trigger. And there's teachings of the triggers. And again, that's something that I help them overcome. Not to avoid these triggers, but to ultimately to see them as opportunities to further your growth and progress. And like, I had a man reach out to me there at the beginning of this year, maybe 6 months ago. And he was in a really bad place in his marriage. He was having a lot of difficulties with his wife, who was going through postnatal depression. And he wasn't able to withstand the level of conflict and her temperament during her difficulties. And he would run away from it. He'd distract himself from it. He would, use excuses such as work or, you know, not be home at certain times of the day, just to avoid the pain that he felt whenever she was expressing her difficulties, which was often directed towards him. So we went through that process and we understood that, you know, this was something that was linked to his earlier experiences where his mum was angry with him as a child. And, you know, this is again the fear of the angry mother. If the mother is angry, then I believe she doesn't love me anymore, and I can't do with a mother that doesn't love me. I can't survive with a mother that doesn't want me. So I better do everything I can to keep her happy so she'll continue to love me and she won't leave me. So again, it's been triggered by his wife. Now, only this week he reached out to me, and he, a completely different man. His wife, her whatever expressions of anger or rage, which she has less frequently now, he's going towards it. He's going, great, here's an opportunity for me to help her feel safe, help her feel protected, help her feel loved. And the more he's been doing that, obviously the less frequently the outbursts of anger have been, because she feels safer, she trusts him. And, you know, that's all based on changing the stories that he believed about himself based on the reactions of his mother when he expressed himself or when she expressed himself in his earlier years. So that's the impact of that. And that's, a very short snippet of a success story of one of the guys I work with. So, yeah.
Brilliant.
That's about it.
Well, where can people find it, most importantly?
Well, people can find me on any social media site. I'll be down. You'll find me at Gavin Meenan. It's just my full name, Gavin Meenan. And if there's another Gavin Meenan out there, he's pretty pissed off because I've put that handle on every single social media site. TikTok, Instagram's the main one. Facebook, don't do much on Twitter, but Instagram is the main one you'll find me on. So Gavin Meenan, and if you reach out to me there, I'll happily reply to your DM and help you out any way I can.
Beautiful. Well, Gavin, I want to say thank you so much. It's been an amazing conversation. I also want to say thank you because I was a guest on your podcast, which you have a podcast as well for people
brilliant
out there.
Brilliant conversation. Yes.
So, but yeah, I want to thank you so much for coming on mine this time and being so generous with your time.
Again, a privilege, an honor, and very excited for us to come for you. And for anyone listening to this podcast, go and check out my conversation with this good man as well. Really, really enjoy that episode. So go and check it out.